I'm sure most of you saw the human development indicator that he was showing in different. He took that to Kashmir too, and he took a picture with it, and that was everywhere.
So Kashmir is doing well. It is doing well, despite the fact it has had a huge conflict and so much draining on the economy happening every day. There are hartals and there are blockades and there are blocks happening. Sometimes there are hartals and breaks in business during the time when it's good for tourism during summertime. But despite that, because one of the things that as India did inside Kashmir is it created a mammoth bureaucracy. And I know that's a post-colonial syndrome. It's happening in other parts of India as well. It has a mammoth bureaucracy, and which means that agar band do mahine bhi rahega, there are going to be people who are going to be paid, and you know, there will be some kind of circulation in the economy. And then also a huge number of people are outside. They're in the Gulf, they're in the West, they're bringing their remittances coming home. So these are the two things. And then tourism needs to be very big. I don't think tourism is that big, and there are statistics to back that up. Tourism is an industry that is very symbolic of Kashmir. So regarding poverty, I think there are statistics, and I might be wrong, but there is not more than a few hundred families that don't own a home. So what initially happened when Sheikh Abdullah came into power, even after that election, he was thrown out of power right after that election, 53. He mobilized this law which was called land to tiller. So they took land from the big landed farmers and then they distributed it equally between the serfs and the peasants who had actually been living in penury till then and living in indentured labor. So I think that really set Kashmiri society on a path where many people became self-sufficient. And again, a lot of people, when they look at Kashmiri movement, they also see it as a class war. And they also see, you know, Kashmiri Pandits, they were very well educated, and there were also many of them, not all of them. They were landed, not farmers, but they were landowners. So in the last 60 to 70 years, Kashmiri Muslims also got education and they also began to get land and they also kind of like began to emerge. So that tussle was also beginning to kind of boil under the subterranean, the layerings of the movement and the armed movement. That kind of tussle was also going between the two communities. Now, a lot of people do not talk about that, and I think that needs to be talked about. And I'm a huge votary of talking, and even if we come to fist fight, but I don't know how far we can go. So coming back to the poverty point first and then going to that, I don't think the situation in Kashmir is worse than what it would be in Bihar or what it would be in other parts of India or what it would be in any routine part of India. I think it's been used as a red herring. It has been used to appropriate narrative, gender discrimination, poverty. But there's one thing that we really need to consider. I also think, like, is India really at the liberty to not open up places like Kashmir? The day Myanmar opened Arakan, I think is symbolic for everyone, because Kashmir has resources, and you already see a lot of people. I don't know how active that is going to be in near future. But you already see these big, huge tycoons pledging that they're going to start industries, they're going to do investments. Because India is a neoliberal economy. I mean, it's dispossessing its own people. I think 2 million people very recently, indigenous people all across India are under assault. Now, no one has really considered Kashmiris as indigenous people. No one has really considered Kashmir as a native indigenous people's rights issue. But I think it needs to be, we need that vantage as well. Because Kashmiris want control of their own resources, and they have for long wanted control of their water, they have for long wanted control of their hydroelectricity projects in Kashmir, and they haven't had it. The past governments, even though they are pro-India, they've always been asking that the NHPC, have this, some kind of a pact with Kashmir, so we don't have to buy our own electricity back. Or it's not as if we are getting socks from India.
So I think that also needs to be by people who are emancipated enough. They need to see the struggle also a struggle against neoliberalism. Because if you go to Kashmir right now, it's not as if you don't see investment. The Grand Lalit is there, Taj Vivanta is there. You have n number of businesses from Delhi operating inside Kashmir. There are people who have taken lease for 59 years on a very minuscule amount. They're owning huge properties under the lessees, but they still own those properties in a way. They possess them and they are profiting off them. And they don't belong to Kashmiris. And that's not just one business. That's not just one hotel. Those are many, many businesses in Kashmir. And that's how the continuity between India and Kashmir has been impeded over the years. And all of those have come to Article 370, which I think one of the, I don't know what, I forget his name, the Stephanie Prime Minister of India, who used to be like the Prime Minister every time someone died. What was his name? So anyways, he called 370 a tunnel through which they could pass everything. So it has happened. So the power thing, I seriously think, you have to read up on your own, and I might also direct you to some resources if you're interested, but I think the gender discrimination angle, I think the poverty angle, I think when Modi invokes poverty, I think he's actually saying, I am so prone and I am so weak in the neoliberal forces. And it's not just Kashmir that's going to be opened up. It's going to be other economies that will be opened up. Yeah.
I have a follow-up. So about that third option, Kashmir become an independent state, you know. So there is school of thought, they say in last 70 years, Kashmir is not managed to maintain law and order as in one another state of the country, you know. So if we are giving that autonomy to Kashmir, are they competent enough to hold that? Are they responsible enough to hold that liberty? Because this is our border area, so it could become a threat for India. What is your take on that? Is Kashmir ready to become an independent state completely on their own?
Well, I think it's a very colonial advantage to say that, oh, are you people equipped enough? So we're going to hold on to it and we're going to teach you a lesson and then maybe. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it, like when you say giving Kashmir autonomy, I don't think there's a question of giving Kashmir autonomy. Kashmir had autonomy that was eviscerated, and people for the last 72 years, 77, I can't count from 1931, I think, but from the last 72 years, people have been, they have been protesting the evisceration of that autonomy. In the 60s, they protested because in 64, so in 1954, I think we really need to see what was taken away from Kashmiris from 54 onwards with the presidential statutes that were put through Article 70, slowly a funnel to Kashmir. 1964 is the time when one of the biggest movements in Kashmir takes place right after the tackle of President Prime Minister was taken away from the what is now the Chief Minister and so Kashmiris at that time felt like, okay, their nationalism is gone. They have been in. So that is actually the time when a lot of people felt hopeless. And 1965 is also the time we had the first armed movement, the Al-Fatah movement. And where do you go for help but across the LOC? I mean, the across the LOC may seem like border bar people, but they're just not people. I mean, that's the advantage, you know, you have to emphasize a little bit. So of course, it's very easy to say these are threats. It's very easy to say cross-border, when there is no international border inside Kashmir. Like, even Chief of Army uses the word cross-border in literature, and I'm like, where is this border? Can you please tell us? There is an LOC, and you don't treat it as a border. And it was, of course, a border till very recently. There's so many forces at play, but I think when you say it can meet that autonomy to Kashmir, isn't it going to become dangerous to India? I think it's also, I don't know if I can invoke morality or ethics at this point in time, but I don't think autonomy was anyone's view. It was already there. The protestations that are in the 60s were against it slowly by little. And then people suddenly realized that it's going to be taken up fully, it's never going to be filibustered. And in 87, Kashmir tried to portray, you know, the I'm sure some of you know Salahuddin, the head of the Jihad Council, in Muzaffarabad. Do you know who stood up for elections in 87?
Yeah, he became an MLA.
Yeah, and he would wear a shroud. And there was a group of people who now are active militants. And they put a shroud, they called it a kafan posh, because they said this is a do or die situation, because we haven't been heard for. So what I think has happened is that India thought they are going to integrate Kashmiris because we are doing the things that need to be done. There was territorial sovereignty, of course, that was a direct, it was kind of an underhand, a different government that were mostly predetermined. But people always were very unique. People have always held on to their identity. People have always held on to their history. So the struggle that you see in Kashmir right now, it's very cultural system. It's seriously, the politics has become culture. It's a very cultural resistance, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have a very specific question. Do you think plebiscite was possible after 370 came into place? After the constitution of Jammu and Kashmir was finally made, do you think plebiscite was possible thereafter? Because this is the narrative which is, I think, actually affecting the Azad Kashmir forces. Not that I have anything against any of these narratives, but I think, yes, people do have their rights to their own culture, but then again, politically speaking, we need to understand that these are two giants fighting for water. Pakistan has a justifiable claim because there is water flowing to Pakistan. India is insecure of its territory. Maharaja accedes, right, unconditionally to India just for three things, right? Thereafter, the Constituent Assembly is made out, and virtually that is like an election. The Constituent Assembly is formulated, and thereafter they say under Section 185 of the Constitution of Jammu and Kashmir that yes, we are with India. Don't you think after this, the narrative of plebiscite was futile? Because by that time, by Article 370 or Article 306 capital A in the Constituent Assembly, you came in part 1 of the Constitution of India. So even if India wanted to give away Kashmir, it was not legally possible.
Give to whom?
Give away Kashmir to Pacistan after plebiscite. So my specific question.
So here's one thing that I want to correct you on. You said that Maharaja acceded unconditionally. You will have to go back to the
three conditions.
It wasn't those were the three subjects.
Yes.
Yes. In fact, the four, there was foreign affairs, currency, defense, and
trade. Yes.
But it wasn't an unconditional. It was conditioned. In fact, Mountbatten plan offered plebiscite, and that was written in quick session. So I have the copy. I have the draft. If you need that.
Okay.
So tell the wishes of the people. Whichever they got, that is however long the expression will last.
Agree.
Okay? So that's one. For two, when the Constituent Assembly comes into being and 370 is made, 370 is still an interim provision till the
370 is an interim provision in terms that the Constituent Assembly of Jammu and Kashmir comes into being, and the Constituent Assembly of Jammu and Kashmir sees whether it has to go with, continue with India or not.
No, it just comes to being to draft 370, and if you kind of read that, and when they dissolved the Constituent Assembly in 1956, they thought that because these were pro-Indian politicians writing it, they thought that they had forever put this part of Kashmir to the India, because they had dissolved the assembly. That was what they believed.
Right.
So again, clock of plebiscite goes away. I have written about it, and I can send you the links. Here's the thing. I feel like the Kashmiri, I'm always put on the step to define these articles. I'm not a legal jurist. I'm an anthropologist, and the kind of work that I've read my thing, and I have distilled that so that you know, it's easily understandable to people. Syllabus site never goes away. Syllabus site doesn't go away even after 370. And what people actually are trying to kind of also the fact that electoral democracy in Kashmir, when the constituent assembly is happening, even that is being, what I was talking to you about earlier, that the governments have been in Kashmir, they have been rich, they have been proud, but at the same time, people have always taken part in those elections with the promise of Philip's side, which is why right now you see National Conference and PDP. Give me a moment, I'll just wrap up and give it to you. Right now, a National Conference and PDP, even Satya Pal Malik, yes, they said, when people go to the gym, they become politicians and they have bigger political careers.
Yes.
What these people are actually negotiating right now is that once they come out of the detainment, don't talk about a soft economy, don't talk about anything else, just talk about the strengthening the union territory. So if you go back to those legal documents and you look at them, you will see that the plebiscite never goes away. 70, it is an interim article, an interim connection with India, till that is done.
So my question is, India as a state does not have the power to give away its own territory, right? So if we, just hear me out. I am of the view, just to clarify, that this abrogation of 370, right, is absolutely illegal. Is absolutely illegal. I am not with it. But I still feel that the concept of plebiscite dies once 370 comes into play, because India does not have power to give away its own territory.
No, the thing is that you also have to think that India still maintains that the other side is under Pakistan's occupation. And whenever there is an election and nomination and constituents, they also count the seats in Afghan Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what also happened when the first election was done.
Of course.
In that scheme of things, the 370 is an interim till the case of entire region is decided. And the other side is also, there is one of the legal, there's enough legal argument that was Maharaja. Like, if you're talking accession and if you're talking signatures and contestation around the legal documents, there is also a view that was Maharaja even, it wasn't even valid for him to sign off the entire territory. Then how was liberated? And that liberation was not done by, that liberation was done by the Punchi fighters that fought in the World War. They really, right, even right now, if you think about the skirmishes, they happen in Punch. Because these are old fighters. These people have fought for long in the World War, and those are the people, that's the continuity, have liberated themselves. So there are a few legal scholars, Christopher Snedden, Alan Lamb, talk about whether Maharaja was at liberty to give that entire territory away when half of it was, one third was already liberated. You know, when we start to Kashmir, we think all of this, it's a constitutional movement.
Yes.
And India just stepped into one. And I know because of the kind of majority and the kind of ethos that has developed in India, sadly, right now, and because of the neoliberal forces that are going to prop it up,
mm-hmm.
they may get away with it.
Yes, they might.
And they might get away with it, but there is also going to be a huge resistance. And here's another thing that I see. If you see Farooq Abdullah,
yes.
If you see Umar Abdullah,
yes.
If you see Mehbooba Mufti, all of them come from a legacy that they have, their forefathers have fought for autonomy, their forefathers have fought for independence of Kashmir one way or the other. They're really well-versed in history. They really have that strain. They have a rebel. I don't like any of them, but they have a rebel germ in their mind, which is why most of them would come on the plan. And no one Kashmir won point blank by saying we are with India. Everyone won the election in Kashmir, whatever the foundation of that election is, by saying that, you know, we'll get more autonomy, we'll get greater Kashmir, we will get this and that, we will get our old honor back. That's how they would come. Because people in all decades have waited for that purpose. Go to any Kashmiri, they know their accession, they know their legal documents. They will give you, you know, toe-to-toe fight. local Harvard, he have all his documents right. Because plebiscite is not something, and this is time and again come from the Indian narrative that plebiscite is gone because Pakistan refused to take its army. I mean, so all of this, but I get your point, which you're saying, but I think autonomy doesn't go away with 370.
I'm saying plebiscite is gone because the constitution of Jammu and Kashmir was made. Once the constitution of Jammu and Kashmir was made, plebiscite is gone. And I have nothing to do with Pakistan. I'm saying the people formulated the Constituent Assembly of Pakistan of Jammu and Kashmir, and the Constituent Assembly of Jammu and Kashmir came up with a document, Constitution of Jammu and Kashmir. That is where plebiscite dies.
I don't think the plebiscite dies with the making of Constitution of Kashmir. I don't think that really kills plebiscite, because plebiscite even stays after 370. So I mean, we can have different views on it, and we can kind of like it will get us nowhere. But here's the thing: I don't even consider plebiscite a valid option if it doesn't have the option for independence. It's a colonial option that was given by Mountbatten, that he kind of put it. It's in the instrument of accession too.
Yes.
And he also, when Maharaja writes to him, he actually tells him that you cannot just sign off, but you will have to ask the people.
Yes.
So he was being very magnanimous at that time. So it's always been there, and we can kind of like go on and on about it. But I feel like plebiscite is a very incomplete option for Kashmiris at this moment. I don't know about how things are going to go in the future, but at this moment it's complete. It doesn't have all the options that Kashmiris need. But at the same time, I don't think it's been invalidated.
I just had a quick question. How do you
Yes, I can. Yeah, there's like lots of resonances, but I don't think it's reductively we can kind of like it's a post-colonial situation. It's been internationalized, just like Palestine being one of the oldest issues on the United Nations agenda. Kashmir is also one of the first ones to go there. And then also there are some resonances on ground because Kashmiris hugely. I'm actually right now guest editing a journal where we are kind of getting scholars from Palestine and Kashmir together to write, draw parallels, but then also talk about differences. And I think there are huge differences. Kashmir is not a settler colonial issue, at least not till this point. There are settler colonial strands because if you think about the Jammu massacre, a lot of people think of it as the Kashmiri Nakba. And now after 2008, with the kind of pilgrimage politics, not that pilgrimage is not important, I feel like religious rituals and religious customs of all people should be facilitated, and people should go back and forth in a cultural organic flux. But as a policy, as recognition of pilgrimages that has happened, I think since 2008, there have been more and more resonances with what probably Israel has done inside West Bank, and it has also done in Gaza, so to speak. Right now, the lockdown seems like Gaza. So there are those resonances, but I think at the same time, I don't see it as a very reductive parallel. I think it's you could kind of like, if you look at the Xinjiang, if you look at the Uyghur situation, I feel like it, in the long run, it might be something like that we are dealing with rather than the Palestinian situation. But of course, there are resonances. Kashmiris hugely have an affective solidarity with Palestinians. And I don't think anywhere else in the world a person is killed just because they are showing solidarity with someone. And that has happened in Kashmir time and again, that a protester dies because they are protesting against Gaza or something like that. So I don't reductively think that there are parallels. There are resonances, but they are hugely different as well. But there are dangers of settler colonialism, what one of the Kashmiri scholars has called as demographic terrorism that India might be doing. So we might have a Palestine on our hands as well.
I'm curious to know about
obviously there's a lot of information that's being blocked in the region of Kashmir as of now since military forces have been occupied there. I'm curious to know about the legality of that, considering that landmines aren't operating, foreign students in the area are being forced to either flee the region or block any sort of communication. I'm curious to know what you think is one, the legal aspect of that, also what's the plan forward in terms of renewing communication or renewing the possibility of contact or getting in touch with people in the area and trying to know whether on-ground services, on-ground businesses, whether the sentiments are still valid and whether there's any way of being in communication with them.
So number one, I think if you look at the report last year, when the United Nations Commission moderated the report on both sides of Kashmir, mainly the human rights violations that had occurred in Kashmir 2016 onwards, there are clear pointers that these are war crimes. And right now what's happening to clamp down and the kind of situation, the humanitarian crisis unfolding, these look like war crimes. They are flouting all international rules and regulations. And most of the human rights organizations, including the United Nations, is time and again trying to remind India that this is a humanitarian crisis unfolding and we have to let go, we have to ease the clampdown in some ways. And the reports that we're getting, they're heartbreaking, like even in my Facebook. And I mean, this is just anecdotal. This is not news report, this is Amnesty saying anything, this is not Human Rights Watch, which very recently we saw Lance stepping in. And a lot of people were like, oh, these are people, there's a maximization of Pakistanis, or these people are Pakistani diaspora speaking. But Dr. Richard Horton, heading the editorial board at the Lancet, he said that they step in an economic humanitarian crisis, which is, and they will take part in a political crisis that happens because that leads to a political humanitarian crisis. And they both are interrelated, and they've always commented on it. This only after 2 weeks of the countdown. So which means that something very serious is happening on the ground. And these are people, and then you also probably, I don't know if you notice, the Hindu has covered this story, Indian Express covered this story, even this doctor, he came on the road and he said, my patients are not getting the care that they need. Some dialysis patients are not getting the care they need. And then he was whisked away, he was arrested, and no one knows where he is. So right now, it's a police state, it's a draconian, it's a terrible situation inside Kashmir that is unfolding. There is no government. You have Satyapal Malik talking about what Delhi is doing and being very magnanimous in the words that he uses. But on ground, the situation is grim. Kids are being detained, 12 years old, 11 years old. People are being beaten. And the only thoroughfare you probably have inside the city is the civil lines and the road that goes towards airport, and journalists are not able to report. This is the first time. Kashmiri journalists have always worked under surveillance. They've never been at the liberty to report the way they would have wanted to, and I'm sure I was one of those. But right now, the situation is grim. They're not able to write anything. They're not able to express anything. So all of this kind of clampdown, to me, they shriek war crimes. So I don't know how India is going to be getting away with it. It has in a way so far. It does have that kind of clout with the kind of market it has, not the kind of economy it has, because everyone looks at the market and not how the economy is going. So I feel like all the neoliberal forces, they might set things right for it, but in the long run, this catches up. So on the international front, there are eyes watching India, and I think it might come to a head at some point. But regarding you talking about what's happening on the ground, did you have a question on the economic front? You said something about the people. I don't remember that part. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just curious about whether it's possible for, say, college students, for people who are business persons working in the area, whether it's possible for them to get back to their daily lives in terms of making their livelihoods or their wages, like that.
So right now, It's a very strange situation. You know, Kashmiris, there was a clampdown imposed on them. And they lifted a few days back. You know what they did? They refused to come out of their houses. And one of the shopkeepers, it's also documented somewhere in court, he said, first they're putting us inside home saying, don't come out. And now the tyranny is such, now they're making us come out because we don't want to come out. That's the strategy. That's one of the civil disobedience that Kashmiris have been doing for the last 33 years, very actively. They've done this against Maharaja too, when they do civil curfew. Everyone takes part in that. No one really comes out. A lot of like to critique this as like Kashmiris coming karna chahte hain. But the fact is that many people who are hawkers or daily vendors, they're also staying home. And they're trying to open schools in the posh areas. They have some landlines open in the posh areas. They have some traffic open in the posh areas and around hospitals. But I don't think anything is coming to normalcy. And right now, as I was kind of waiting for all of you to set up, the Deccan Chronicle is reporting that this situation might go on till October and beyond. The kind of clampdown that is in Kashmir right now. And my fear is, there were conversations and there were also reports where you could see that the BJP government is really, really ready to deal with this kind of a situation for 2 long years, and it's ready for casualties as well. And it doesn't really care about the world opinion, because at this point in time, all the neoliberal forces, they're with India. But, you know, it's only a matter of time before all of that catches up with the government. So I don't know. I don't know what if the situation coming to normalcy. You also have to see like what's normal for Kashmir. Kashmir has never been normal in the last 33 years, never since 72 years. Because in every decade, which is why that desolation called peace. I did that book. I edited that book with a colleague of mine. And the reason we did that was I wanted to tell the Indian readers that, you know, you have to really pay attention beyond the jingoism, beyond the nationalistic media. That this struggle has been there forever. Like you hear a narrative from one of the professors who's been a mentor of mine, and he's growing up in the early 50s. And the kind of story he writes is the story that I could write today. And is the story that my son could write tomorrow. It's exactly like this. You know, you saw Shah Faisal coming up, right? Like Shah Faisal, the young politician who was an IAS officer before. So you saw him come up. A lot of people, a lot of Kashmiris and a lot of Indians saw hope in him. They thought, oh, you know, he's very upcoming, smart, transparent politician, going to be a technocrat. And because I had kind of like me and other people, we have paid attention to these things that have happened in the past decades. Shah Faisal is not a new thing. This kind of person has always emerged in every decade. India has engineered and used them in the same manner. I mean, every person was a Shah Faisal of his own decade, maybe definitely not having an IAS qualification, but they have been in their era, they have had some sort of a newness, but then the narrative was the same. And if you read that desolation, if you read those essays, you'll see those resonances everywhere. And that really helps people to understand that maybe you shouldn't think of it just a proxy war. Maybe we should give Kashmiris, like, you know, earlier the question was like, are you even up to having your autonomy and trying to govern yourself? Kashmiris have always been treated as if they didn't know their history, as if now something new is going to come and help them do something. They have met these streets and these realities of the past as well, which is why they're very disappointed at this moment. And I think a lot of people think it's so discriminatory for them to say, hey, we don't want anyone else to buy land in Kashmir. We don't want anyone else to have franchise in Kashmir. I think you have to see them as very stricken people. You have to see them as cornered people from both sides, not just one side. There might be an affective relationship with Pakistan because of the geographical contiguity, of the previous cultural ties, of religious ties, and what they have kind of like being able to portray, and also what they're doing in the other side, although there is a huge repression on that side, but they have gone all crazy. They have done all kinds of things. And now parts of Gilgit-Baltistan and all of them, they also want a greater connection with Pakistan. So it's kind of like really strange looking at that side. So we have to understand that what has happened in every decade with Kashmiris, that their history has not been understood fully. And you know, as an anthropologist, I also say I don't want to argue Kashmir's case. I really want to look at informations around India's borders. and kind of like see the resonance. And see the resonances with the indigenous peoples, the folk people dwelling in forests, the Adivasis, the Dalits that is happening inside India. I think there's so many resonances and there's so much to draw from. And so much to draw from that India is a neoliberal state at the moment. It is a neo-colonial state. It is a neo-imperial state. And there's no shame in owning that, because I think the big powers have set us up like that. They have set up the subcontinent to claw at each other so that there's no prosperity in the region. So I think it's high time that people who are thinking about these things stop thinking together rather than thinking it's a Kashmiri problem, it's a Dalit problem, it's a Northeastern problem. I think we have to build solidarities that are able to think of some kind of a subcontinental commonwealth rather than these big countries that are to no good. So I don't know if that's too idealistic, but that's what I think. Yeah, nothing good. And a big hug from me to you all. I wish I could talk one-on-one, but maybe, you know, you can send me a photograph of everyone's name.
Some postcards.
I'm sorry?
Some postcards.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you so much for organizing this. Thank you so much for listening to me.